the faith that Christ had to have to do what he did. And then my next thought was the faith that Moses had to do, or had to have to do what he did. The faith that his mother had to have to put him in the bulrushes in a little basket, with his sister watching over him. To be raised as a child of the Pharaoh and come back and lead his children away from all that he had grown to know and to appreciate. And no matter what we would talk about, I think it would work in pretty well with what I had in mind to say today, at least I hope it does. Because I'd like to talk to you about time. And I hope not to take too much time doing it. But who amongst you would define for me what time is? Anybody want to take a try at it? We don't care if you're old or young. What is time to you? If you had to explain to somebody what time is, how would you describe it? Well, it's important to me because it became a part of my job this past week. And I found myself in a session where I was supposed to learn something, and this was the question they asked us. What is time? If I could give you 1 hour today, what would you do with it? If I could give you 1 hour that you could use over and above the 24 that God has given you, what would you do with it? How would you spend it? How would you use it? What is it? Well, as usual, we go to Webster. We find out what the word means. So I went to Webster. Well, he wasn't real sure either, I don't think. But I'll give you three of his definitions of what time is. And he's got a column about that long in fine print in a big dictionary. But he described time as the indefinite, unlimited duration in which things are considered as happening, both in the past, to the present, and into the future. But in case that doesn't quite get it for you, he offers this thought. It's the entire period of existence of the known universe, the finite duration as distinguished from infinity. In other words, what we can measure and identify as opposed to all that was in existence before time began, which will be in existence after time ends. And I think Webster had a pretty good belief in God, in many of the ways in which he described words. And I think that is, to me, that's an indication that he did anyway, this second explanation. Then he also left one which was the one that was preferred by the group that I was with. He said, time is a continuum in which events succeed one another from past through the present and into the future. Now, all of these were taken from Webster's dictionaries from various times. And the reason that this one was so more appropriate for what we were doing was because they were trying to impress upon us the need to control or be in control or have control of the events in your life. And at first I wasn't too impressed, but then I got to thinking with some of the things that were said, this is what the scriptures have been telling us all along. Choose ye this day who you will serve. This life is a probationary state in which to prepare to meet your God. Anything that happened yesterday, all that happened before you came onto this, the face of this earth, doesn't have anything to do with you. You had no control over it, You were not a part of it, and you're not even a victim of it. It influences what you will do in the future, but you're no part or parcel of anything you said or did. There is another definition that's attributed to a man who was identified as St. Augustine, and I'd like to read it and see if it doesn't kind of fill the thoughts that were going around in your head to some extent, at least, when I asked you to think about time and to identify it. He said, "For what is time? Who is able easily and briefly to explain it? Surely we understand well enough when we speak of it. And what then is time? Well, if nobody asks me, I know. But if I were desirous to explain it to someone, plainly I know not." And this is what went through my mind when I was trying to think of how to evaluate time. But their concept of time, or the concept of time that we considered in this class last week, was how to control our lives so that we got the most out of all the time that we had allotted to us. And the first thing that we have to do is choose what is most important to us. If you're going to get the most out of a day, what's the most important thing you're going to do that day? Is your most important thing getting up, or is it going to bed? Is it eating, or is it working? Is it playing, or is it watching somebody else do something? Are you a participant or an observer? Do you want to make things happen, or do you want to see what's going to happen to you? Do you want to be passive, or do you want to be active? Do you want to be helpful, or do you want to be helped? And so it kind of went right along with some of the other thoughts that I had been going around in my mind when I first talked to Jack last week, actually last Sunday, I think. Someone said that it's my turn to be speaker. I think I kind of knew that as long as I've been gone. But along with these definitions that Webster gave us and for what St. Augustine said, there was a quote brought to our mind that I thought was quite appropriate. It wasn't by a preacher. It wasn't by a philosopher. Well, some people might call him a philosopher. But it was by somebody that all of us know or heard of or are aware of in our education in the English part of this country. Who have studied history of our country in the English literature. I don't know what it is in bilingual schools, but I know it was very much a part of our education in the school that I went to. His name was Benjamin Franklin. And of course, he was attributed to an awful lot of inventions. He made good use of a lot of the time that he had. He was said to have said to his wife, he wished that the days had more hours in them so that he could use that time to make something useful of himself. He was never satisfied with what he did or what he accomplished or what happened. He could always find more things to do than he had time to do them in. But he said, in the quote that we considered, he said, "To love life is to love time. For time is the stuff life is made of." And it is. And many times we say it without even realizing it. We talk about our lifetime. We talk about our parents' lifetime. We talk about the lifetime of Christ. We talk about the lifetime of George Washington, or the lifetime of Moses, or the lifetime of Adam. And we wonder why it is that those men had, some of them 600 to 900 to what was Methuselah, 970 years old before he passed away. Why were they given so much more time than we are given? What was the purpose in that? Was it just to raise more people, replenish the earth? Or was it because of a different attitude that they had? I don't know. But to but to identify what time was or what time is for us in our lifetime, we should think of it as being a series of events that have happened to us or around us. And in order to have control of that time, we have to, in some way or some other, control those events. In order to become a member of the body of Christ, we had to take the time to study, to learn, to determine whether that was for us or not. And if it was, what was required of us. And if we know what was required, were we willing to take the time or spend the time or make a part of our life the event that would take place or transpire to make us a part of the life of Christ. And so we elected, for whatever reason, we elected to do that. And we elected to be baptized. We elected to study. We elected to strive in whatever way that we can to show our peers as well as our master that we are sincere in what we have endeavored to do or what we are trying to do. And so we have learned, without anybody ever teaching us, without ever being aware of it, in most instances, to control the events in our lives so that we can have what we want or what we desire or what we intend to obtain. And so we, to some degree, have learned to control the events in our life. And you say, well, now, Bob, that's not possible. Those people that were in that trade tower the other day, they had no power over that. Then when that bomb went off, they were there, they were trapped, they were caught. But did you notice any of the sayings that different people said when they came down? Some people had nothing but adulation for the help and the praise of the people that helped them get out of there. Other people had nothing but criticism that the doors they went to were locked and the people they looked for help weren't there. And other people considered it an experience that was beneficial to them, and some people considered it an experience that they would never go back. They would never go in there again. And so every event that happens in our life gives us the opportunity to choose how we're going to address that event, what we're going to do, how we're going to react, what we're going to say, what kind of an impression we are going to make on those about us. We don't think of it as making an impression on people, but what we say and what we do leaves an impression in everybody's mind that they remember. And they associate that impression with you as opposed to me or with somebody else. And this identifies to each of us then what each of the other of us is like. Whether we're nice to be around or whether we just soon not be too close. Whether it's fun to be with them when they're, if there's an emergency exists, it's good to be there with that brother or that sister because they know what to do. They may not ever happen to experience it before, but whatever they do, it'll probably be the right thing. So we gain this confidence or this lack of confidence because of the things which we observe. But we observe these things because people react without planning or thinking. They react with what they have through the years learned to control in the events of their life instead of letting the events of their life control them. And these are qualities that businesses and leaders of people look for, but they're also qualities that Christ looks for. And if you look at your scriptures, all through the scriptures we are encouraged to take control of the events of our life, not to be overwhelmed by them, to realize that we don't have the strength ourselves sometimes to do these things. But with God's help, nothing is impossible. This is a good philosophy. It is good training to teach us so that when we are faced with something we haven't ever seen before, We don't have to fear what's going to be the outcome. We know that with God's help, it's going to be good. It may not be what we want, just like what Romy was saying there this morning in his kind of a testimony there in Sunday school. He didn't know what to expect when he got to the hospital, but he knew whatever he found with God's strength, he would be able to handle it. He could accept it. It would be difficult. No matter what he found when he got there, it was going to be difficult. But it would be something that he would be able to accept and to go forward with. And this is what God is trying to teach us all through the scriptures. If you have faith only in yourself, only in your own strength, only in your own ability, you're going to fail. But if you put your faith and your trust in God and put your own abilities to work with God's guidance, you will be on top of everything. It won't always be easy. There won't be times when you think, well, I should have done this or I should have done that, it would have been better. But you will be able to do something that will be good and be helpful and be beneficial to you. You know, when I started thinking about time, I started thinking about, well, time then is just like what I was thinking about when the first verse came to mind that reminded me, that made me think about this even before the meeting that we had there, the class that we had there at the school, was that time is only important to mankind. Only men measure time. God does not measure time. Whatever God reckons his goings and comings and his doings with, I don't know. But it's not on the same scale of time, because he was in existence before the world was created. And he looks to the time when there will be no more time, when the world will cease to exist. I guess the best way to relate that to what I've got to say is he is the master controller of events. He has caused all the events that from the creation that created this thing called time. And he has placed it in our hands to where we can benefit from it and use it. And it can be something that we can use to obtain eternal life. We can't buy anything with it. We can't trade anything with it. But how we use it, how we spend it, how we conduct ourselves while we have it, will determine whether we will be sons and daughters of God, or whether we will be among the those that are weeping and wailing and gnashing their teeth because they elected to throw away this opportunity. I'd like to turn to, there's probably better ones than the one I have chosen perhaps, but I'd like to turn to the 46th chapter of Isaiah to get God's insight or input into what I've been trying to say, I've been trying to put into words. I think all prophets have to be able to express God's words without inflicting, without injecting their own feelings or their own thoughts. But I think that some prophets are better at this than others. And I like Isaiah's ability to do this. I know there's a lot of things in Isaiah I don't understand. I know that we're cautioned by some of the other scriptures that Isaiah speaks in a manner that we don't always understand. And we attribute that to the fact that he is speaking from a Hebrew concept or a Israeli basic knowledge that we don't know. And maybe that's true, but maybe also it's because Isaiah had the ability to express God's wishes or feelings or thoughts as closely to words that we can understand as any of the prophets. In other words, he didn't try to make it understandable to us. He tried to present it just what God was saying. Maybe wrong, but that's one of my things I toss around the back of my head from time to time. I'd like to start with the fifth verse there in the 46th chapter of Isaiah. And he says to Isaiah, "To whom will ye liken me and make me equal? And compare me that we may be like." Who do you know that's like me? Who do you know that you can compare me with, that will give somebody an example of what I am like? He says, "They lavish gold out of the bag, and they weigh silver in the balance, and they hire a goldsmith, and he maketh it a god, and they fall down, yea, they worship it. They bear him upon the shoulder, they carry him, and they set him in his place, and he standeth. And from his place shall he not remove. Yea, one shall cry unto him, yet can he not answer, nor save him out of his trouble. Remember this, and show yourselves men. Bring it again to mind, O ye transgressors. Know that you can worship anything you want, gold, silver, or wood, or whatever. But it's just an object. And the God that created that gold, that created that wood, that created that silver, that created that object, that created this universe, that created this time that we can spend doing these things, he also established laws that we call laws of science. Some people call them laws of nature. But those laws that he established say that when you set that idol, whatever it is, on that table, that's where it's going to sit. The only thing that's going to move that off of that table is gravity, is another human being, or is God. Now, he can leave that sit there, and if he wants that book off that table, he can create an earth tremor that'll shake it off. He can bring the wind to blow it off. He can, if it's made out of the right substance, bring another substance within its presence that'll push it off. But by itself, it cannot move. It's just an object. Don't matter whether it's made out of paper or wood or plastic or gold or silver or whatever it is. It's just an object. And it'll stay there until somebody or something comes along and moves it. With God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that's not so. But that's not what he said here. He said, "Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like unto me. Declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure, calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. Yea, I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have proposed it, I will also do it. Hearken unto me, ye stout-hearted that are far from righteous, or that are far from righteousness, beg your pardon. I bring near my righteousness, it shall not be far off, and my salvation shall not tarry, and I will place salvation in Zion for Israel my glory. And there is no other God, there is no other being, there is no other power on the face of this earth, whether you be Muslim or whether you be whatever some of the Oriental religions are, Hindu, Buddha, Shinto, there's no other being that has that power and that ability like the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob does." I remember and I didn't mark this one down in some of the examples that I gave here. In fact, I thought of a lot of them that I couldn't, but one of them that comes to mind right now that I would like to mention is, I believe it was Baal, they were going to show the power of Baal. And they built this altar, and they put the sticks on it, and they put the sacrifice on the altar. And who was it, Elisha? I shouldn't have even been about this up, but I can't remember. Elijah or Elisha won. Said, "Okay, now you have that, burn that sacrifice." And boy, they prayed, and they chanted, and they jumped up and down, and they went through all kinds of contortions, and they just stood there. And after they had done all that they could do, and it's been a long time since I read the story, I'm probably leaving the good part out, but the part that is impressive to me was after they did all that they could do, he said, "Okay, now dig a trench around it." They did. He said, now go get water and dump water on it. Make it good and wet. They dumped water on until the trenches were full. And Elisha went a ways off. And he knelt down and he prayed. And he prayed to God. And God sent fire from heaven that devoured the water, the sticks, the beast that was put up there for the burnt offering, and all left was the ashes and the stone. Now, who do you trust? Who do you believe? Who has the power? We had the good pleasure of having a good conversation last night with a young fellow and talking about some of the things contained in God's scriptures, and he was trying to convince my companion and myself that the need for these kinds of demonstrations and the need for healings and the need for miraculous events, for lack of a better word, I can't think of the word that he used, is past. That those were there, they were put there for a confirming of the word of Christ, to confirm to the people that Christ indeed empowered his ministry, especially his apostles, to do these things. And that nowadays, that's not necessary. We don't need them because we've got doctors to heal. We've got scientists to invent things. We've got the ability to do all these things ourselves. And we already know that these things took place in the Bible, so we don't have to have any more examples to refresh our minds or to show us that they were true, because we already have that. We have that because we have faith in God. Well, with all due respect, I tried to say it respectfully, and I hope I did. I intended to. I said, I have seen miracles. I have seen people healed. I have seen things happen that there was no physical explanation as to how it could be done. And I said, and I'm not saying that makes me more righteous than you, that doesn't make me better than you, doesn't even make me different than you. But I said, it makes me careful where I tell these things and who I tell these things to, because I said, I don't want to cast my pearls before a swine, but I will testify to God's goodness and to God's mercy and to God's willingness to give unto me and to others around me blessings and miracles like what have been expressed in the scriptures at other times. And I would not want to believe in a God who is partial to the people who lived in Christ's time and then want to be tell us that it's not necessary for us to have that same consideration or to have that same confidence that he is mindful of our needs and our wishes, even as he was to those people who lived and walked with Christ, who lived and walked on this earth at the time that Christ lived and walked here. But anyway, I don't want to get into that. Let's go to another event where God controlled the events. And in controlling the events, he even controlled the outcome of time. First of all, I want to go, before I do that, let's go to the 17th chapter of Exodus and read about, I believe it was Joshua that was fighting the battle. I read so much, I might be giving the wrong person credit here, in the wrong place here. Okay. Said 17th chapter, I started reading the 18th. 17th is over here on this page already. I'm sorry. Okay. 17th chapter of Exodus, and let's start with about the 8th verse. And it was Joshua, because all I could find over here was Jethro's father-in-law, and that was in the 18th chapter. And boy, that wasn't who I'm looking for. But okay, here in the 17th chapter of Exodus, and we're going to start with the 8th verse. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel and Rephidim, however you say that word. And Moses said unto Joshua, choose us out men and go out, fight with Amalek, Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in mine hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him, and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. And so they took a stone, and they put it under him, and he sat thereon. And Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. Okay? And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. No, that's not the part that I wanted. Well, that's okay. That's a good example of how God rewarded Moses and his faith in him. And when, as long as he held, could hold that rod of God up in the air, Joshua prevailed. But whenever that rod started to come down, Joshua and his forces were prevailed upon, and Amalek prevailed. But let's go over here to Joshua. Let's go to the 10th chapter of Joshua. I think this is what I'm looking for. I lost sight of something there. I'm not picking up with what I wanted to say there. Let's go over here to the 10th chapter of Joshua. Okay, and this is what I was looking for. And I'm going to start with about the 12th verse. And read here about the time when God, the manipulator, the controller of events, controlled not only the event, he also controlled time. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Now is not this written in the book of Jasher? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. And there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man. Get this. For the Lord fought for Israel. They were his people, and they asked his help and his assistance, and he gave it them. And he caused the moon to stay where it was in the universe. And he caused the sun not to go down. And what did that entail? How did he do that? The sun doesn't move. The sun was already sitting still. The earth revolves and the earth orbits. But it didn't. It slowed down. Something happened that it, for the space of time that it would take for an extra day to go by, it moved slow enough so that they could accomplish what they had to do. And this miracle, some people might think of it as a fable, but I don't. This miracle happened to show us, to demonstrate to us, that God not only created time, he not only gave us time for our benefit, but he controls time. And he is in command of all of the events that take place in this world. And the more we are willing to give him the go-ahead to control these things in our lives, the better it will be for each of us. The more on top of these things we will be, the better we will be able to control the events of our life. This isn't to say that we can look into the mind of God or that we can have any influence on the mind of God. But if we are willing to allow him to have total influence on our lives, it'll make our lives enough like his that we won't have to worry about the events of this world. We will always, or the events of this life, we will always be there, and he will be there to meet these events, whatever they might be. We may not have any control over what's going to happen. We will have control on how it affects us and how we react to it and how it becomes a part then of our life, our reputation, our outlook, and actually in our confidence, our ability to have confidence in ourselves as well as in confidence in God that He will remember us. I'd like to turn to a few scriptures now to point out some of the things about time. Let's go to the second chapter of Matthew. God controlling or taking charge of the events of the time. I'd like to read the first two verses of the second chapter of Matthew. In fact, I don't even need to read all of the first one, but we will. He said, "Now when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, there came wise men from the east to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he that is born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east, and are come to worship him." They seen an event, and they made it a part of their lives, and they came to make that event a part of their lives, not to make them a part of his life. They didn't come to impress Jesus. They came to worship him because they wanted that to be a part of their lives. And they took the initiative of that event. And I don't think there's, I talk too hard about this idea of there being another king born. In fact, I might have to think of a way to do something about that. Or we can go and we can say, we want to be a part of what is happening. I'll give you another example that I hadn't thought of before, but it comes to mind now. I think it's a good example. When the fire came that destroyed the church building, people could have just thrown up their hands and said, "Oh my goodness, God, let the church be destroyed. We must be in real trouble." But they didn't. They thanked God for the protection that they had the night before, and the building was full to overflowing. They thanked God for all the things that he had seen to it, that even though the building itself was destroyed, there was no life, or no limbs lost. And what property was lost, they could salvage what they wanted, and the rest was of no great material loss. But the events that took place when the people seen this happen, instead of becoming angry or disillusioned or upset with God, they came in there and they utilized their own strength, their own property, their own whatever they had to be a part of that event and to make whatever salvage operation that they could salvage, whatever they could do to help. They were willing to do it. And they elected. They weren't told to come. They weren't asked to come. They weren't organized to come. Just on their own, they made that a part of their life. And they demonstrated what that means to them by the things which they said and the things which they did. And they came to that event, just like the three wise men came to the star at Christ's birth. I'd like to go to 3 Nephi and read another account of this event, of this happening, and how it affected the lives of other people, and how they took this event and made it something beneficial to them. I'd like to start with about the ninth verse. In fact, I probably ought to be closing here instead of just starting, but I'll just use this example, and then I'll forget some of the rest that I've got here. "Now it came to pass that there was a day set apart by the non-believers, the unbelievers, that all those who believed in those traditions should be put to death, except the sign should come to pass, which had been given by Samuel the prophet. Now it came to pass that when Nephi, the son of Nephi, saw this wickedness of his people, his heart was exceeding sorrowful. And it came to pass that he went out and he bowed himself down upon the earth." Now here he was, the event was, they were going to be put to death. And he could have fled. He could have run away from these people. He could have preserved his own hide. He could have got out of there. But he didn't. He elected to be a part of the events that were taking place. "And so he went out and he bowed himself down upon the earth, and he cried mightily unto his God in behalf of his people, yea, those which were about to be destroyed because of their faith in the tradition of their fathers. And it came to pass that he cried mightily unto the Lord all that day, and behold, he wasn't let down. The voice of the Lord came to him, saying, Lift up your head and be of good cheer, for behold, the time is at hand, and on this night shall the sign be given. And on the morrow come I into the world to show unto the world that I will fulfill all that which I have caused to be spoken by the mouths of my holy prophets. Behold, I will come unto my own to fulfill all things which I have made known unto the children of men from the foundation of the world, and to do the will both of the Father and of the Son of the Father because of me, and of the Son because of my flesh. And behold, the time is at hand, and this night shall the sign be given. And it came to pass there was a day, and a night, and a day when there was no darkness. The sun went down. The earth continued in its orbit around the sun, and it continued in its rotation on its axis. But the light didn't go away. Darkness didn't come on. And the light showed to the people that here was the person most able to control events, had taken this way to control this event, and he made it so that the nighttime was as bright as the day, and it wasn't moonlight, it was daylight. There's a difference. All of us know that. I had several others that I was going to refer to, but I would like to just like to quote one thing that I looked in the scriptures for a long time to find, and I couldn't find it. Finally, I come to the realization that it wasn't in the scriptures. But when we sing the song, When the World is Called Up Yonder, and the first words, the first sentence, or the first part of the first sentence, however it is, when the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time shall be no more. I was so sure that was in the scripture somewhere, but it isn't. At least I don't think it is. I couldn't find it. But it's in that song. When the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time shall be no more. And it would have been nice if I could have got to some of these other ones, especially in John and 3 Nephi and Peter, because Christ himself explained to us, work now while it is daylight. Work now while you have the time, because soon the night time cometh when no work can be done. And when the Lord's trumpet sounds and we go to meet him, whether we are middle-aged or old-aged or young-aged, whether it's the end of the world or just the end of our life, time ceases for us. And all that's happened in the past, all that's happened up to this present, ends right there. Time, that gift that we take for granted and don't really appreciate and can hardly identify, ceases to exist. No more do we have the opportunity to do works or to accomplish good or to do evil. The spirit that possesses our body when that time comes possesses that body when we come before God to be judged. And the scriptures tells us that. So that point in our lives, time ceases. It doesn't cease for all those who are left. It doesn't cease for all those who sing at our funeral or who come to mourn our loss or who are glad to see that we're gone. But it ceases for us. Time only exists as long as life is in our body and in our soul. So make the best of it. And remember what God said to Isaiah. I was going to turn to it and read it, but I won't. You can remember it. And if you can, it's in the 46th chapter of Isaiah. Anything else that you want to worship, it's just an object that sits there. It can't answer you. It can't help you when you're in trouble. It can't change anything for itself. And it certainly can't change anything for you. But the God in heaven, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God that gave his only begotten Son, the God that created all the things that substantiate our creation, is there. And he wants you to come unto him. He's provided the way, the means, and the wherewithal that we can come back into His presence. And He gave His only Son as a sacrifice that we might obtain it, that we might be worthy of it. Let us not leave ourselves down in not taking advantage of that. God bless you.
Thank you, Brother Bob. I toyed with changing the song to Take Time to Be Holy, but we still do have a good song selected, number 165. 165. Would you stand, please?